We're glad that you're here for tonight's lecture by David Oliver Rellin. There are a number of events over the next couple of weeks that we also want to highlight while you're here, namely the Whitworth Theater production of The Cradle Will Rock under the direction of Dr. Diana Trotter, thus the stage behind me. Next week's visit by Pastor Greg Boyd, the Ross Sawyer's art exhibit in the new Lead Center for the Visual Arts, a faith, philosophy, and film lecture by Doug Guyvett. That's next week. In the Science and Society lecture by NASA scientist John Horak. Those are all next week. We think there's something for just about everybody in the next 2 weeks' time. And we'd also ask you before we formally introduce Mr. Rellin that if you haven't double-checked yet and make sure that your phones are off, anything that might buzz or ring out of courtesy to our speaker and out of courtesy to your neighbors, if you would just double-check and make sure that those won't be ringing while Mr. Rellin is presenting. Well, for two decades, award-winning journalist David Oliver Rellin has focused on reporting about social issues and their effects on children, both in the United States and around the world. In his work as an investigative journalist, Rellin has also been committed to increasing awareness about critical human rights issues. As part of their first-year experience at Whitworth, freshmen have all read and discussed Mr. Rellin's best-selling and award-winning book, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. Tonight, Mr. Rellin will share this incredible account of humanitarian endeavor. And by the way, Whitworth students have registered with the Pennies for Peace program, and that grew out of their engagement with this book, and students will be have jars at the back of the auditorium as you exit, and you can deposit your pennies. Well, Three Cups of Tea was a runaway New York Times bestseller. In 2007, it was also selected as Time Magazine's Asia Book of the Year and as a Critic's Choice by People Magazine. It was also awarded the 2007 Kiriyama Prize for Nonfiction and chosen as the 2007 Pacific Northwest Bookseller's Book of the Year. Today, in his visit to Whitworth, Mr. Rellin has met with freshman seminar faculty. He's visited Dr. John Yoder's Third World class. And over dinner, he's met with a group of freshman students. Immediately following his address, he will be signing books. We don't have books for sale, but he will be signing books if you brought those directly in front of me. Tonight, Mr. Rellin will speak for approximately 60 minutes, and then for 15 minutes after that, we will raise the house lights, and he will entertain questions from the audience. So with that, please welcome Mr. David Oliver Rellin.
I want to thank Scott McQuilkin, who has shepherded me so incredibly ably all day as I've seen so many different facets of the Whitworth community. He's also acted as a de facto bodyguard. And I just want to say, as athletic director, your skills really show that clothesline tackle of the student who was trying to get a book signed was maybe a little over the top, but nevertheless very effective. So thank you. And I want to thank Heather Rogers, the director of the Freshman Seminar, who has also taken very good care of me today. Thanks, Heather. And I want to thank the Whitworth Drama Department for painting the set especially for me tonight. I did sort of expect to see Himalayan peaks and teacups and shalwar kameez, but I'm just going to try to go with the flow here. And if someone has a fedora and a trench coat that I could borrow, I'll try to work with this set. I am going to talk, I'll be doing things here on stage for about an hour. I'm not exactly sure what those things will be. The first 10 or 15 minutes or so, we'll find out what comes out of my mouth. And then I'm going to show you some pictures from the three trips that I took to northern Pakistan while I was reporting Three Cups of Tea. And I'm also going to show you a couple pictures from the book that I'm working on right now and from a couple of the recent trips that I've just taken the last few months to Asia for some of the projects that I'm working on. But I want to apologize to people in the Spokane community tonight if I seem to neglect you just a little bit, because I want to speak directly to the Whitworth students this evening. Whitworth students have had pointed objects poked at them to force them to read my book, and have been threatened with GPA damage if they don't show up this evening. So since you've been through the ringer for me, I'd like to speak directly to you. I've had a very strange career. I suspect a lot of you will too, but let me tell you a little bit about mine and how I got involved working in journalism. When I graduated from college, my parents gave me the most unbelievable gift any parents could ever give. They knew that I was itching to see the world. They knew that I'd studied Asian politics. And they said, all right, we know what's coming. We'd rather we got this started now while we can keep track of it. So we're giving you a plane ticket anywhere in the world. That's your graduation present. Where will you go? Well, my parents knew me very well, and it was an experience that changed my life. And I thought long and hard about where I wanted to go, and India was the place that seemed like a good first culture shock, life-changing experience, and it was for me. So I went to India, and I bought an old World War II-era motorcycle called an Enfield. And I spent 6 months riding around India, breaking down spectacularly in front of people's homes, getting invited in for tea, and learning firsthand about the hospitality of people in some of the poorest places in the world. When I got back from that trip, I began doing the kind of journalism work that a lot of young journalism students do, the unfascinating kind. I interviewed celebrities. I interviewed famous athletes. I interviewed politicians. That was probably the least entertaining of the group of three. And the thing that I noticed about these three groups of people was that they had very, very high opinions of themselves very often, opinions that I couldn't quite match up with what they'd actually accomplished. And about this time, I had an assignment or two where I ended up following around and writing about somebody who was working in a humanitarian field and trying to make the world a better place. And I thought, these are people who don't come with publicists and aren't trumpeting their achievements, but are actually doing amazing things. And I found them much more interesting. And they also seemed to me much happier on the whole than the professional athletes and the celebrities and politicians that I was talking to. And about this time, I went to a lecture by a terrific writer named Grace Paley, who passed away a few years ago. And Grace Paley, if you're not familiar with her, you should read her stuff, but she was famous for expressing her political opinions and telling young writers what she thought they should be doing. And she sort of looked like a female Einstein, if that helps the picture come into focus. And what Grace Paley said the evening I heard her speak was this. It's the duty of a writer, she said, to listen to the stories of the powerless and tell those stories to the powerful. And that really resonated with me. I thought, that's pretty good. That's not a bad job description if I can pull this off. And that's what I've tried to do since. I've spent 23 years now, some unfascinating, most very rewarding, traveling a lot, seeing a lot, guzzling a lot of tea in people's homes, and trying to tell the stories of the powerless to a wider audience, among them the powerful. Now, after 9/11, this whole process changed, and the duty of the writer seemed even more heightened to me. And the question was, what is my responsibility in this time? What can I do? And I found right after 9/11 that I was becoming increasingly frustrated by the way our media was stereotyping and villainizing Muslims. At that point, I had traveled enough in Muslim countries to know that this false division in the media of us and them, our world and their world, was just nonsense. And I tried to write stories about this, tried to write stories that that brought home the point that we have more in common than we have things that separate us. I wrote a story about an Iranian-American family who had a member of their family from Boston on the second plane that hit the World Trade Center. And I wanted to make the point that we're all suffering. We're all in this together. And then shortly after that, the war in Iraq started, and I was asked to be an embedded correspondent. A glossy magazine asked if I would go do that. And I thought, that's not what I want to do. Thousands of people are going to go tell this story, and I don't believe in this story. In fact, I felt like I didn't want to be embedded in what I considered the single greatest foreign policy mistake of my lifetime. So, what could I do? Right about this time, I was introduced to Greg Mortensen. A magazine editor called us both up and said, you two really need to talk to each other. And he more or less locked us in a room. I didn't actually hear the padlock snapping shut, but it sort of felt that way. And he said, just talk. Good things will come out of this. And they did. And Greg and I spent an afternoon together, and we talked about the work that he'd been doing, and he took out his maps and unfolded them and showed me where schools had been built and where he planned to build schools. And then he asked me if I would write a book about his work. And I said, I can't imagine anything more important than that. And I dropped everything else that I was doing. If I'd known that I would spend the next 3 years chasing Greg all over the planet and waiting for Greg hour after hour in hotels and airport lobbies and so on, I might have thought 5 seconds before I said yes. But I still would have said yes. Now, why did I think it was so important to tell Greg's story? Because at a time of national crisis, I felt like our foreign policy was on the wrong track. I felt like it was very important for us to engage in this crisis in a constructive way. And I felt like Greg was one of the only people that I was aware of who was actually fighting the war on terrorism in the only way I think it can be fought, which is addressing the root causes. And by root causes, I mean, instead of focusing on the symptoms of the disease, instead of focusing on people with names like Osama, Greg was rolling up his sleeves every day and working on the true root causes of terrorism, which I believe are poverty and ignorance. And by addressing these root causes, by giving people hope, by improving their lives, Greg was transforming a whole region of the world and doing a better job than our entire government apparatus was doing. And I thought, this is something that's worth getting involved with. So, what I'm going to do is show you some pictures in just a moment. But before I do that, I'd like to read just a page and a half from Three Cups of Tea. And I know all of the freshmen here tonight have read Three Cups of Tea. I ask that whatever your experience with the book, you pay attention to this page and a half. Because if you take away any lesson from Three Cups of Tea, I would hope it would be two things. First of all, the simple fact that one person really can change the world. Greg Mortensen's story is proof of that. And the second thing I hope you'd take away from the book is a piece of wisdom that was expressed to me during an interview with a leader of the military in Pakistan, Brigadier General Bashir Baz. And right as the war in Iraq was starting, I was in Rawalpindi, the military capital of Pakistan, doing an interview with the general. And honestly, I did 250 interviews for Three Cups of Tea. At first, this seemed like just another interview with an important person. But when I finished this interview, I realized the general had said something so profound, I needed to really sit and think about it. And I've thought about it every day since. So I'm going to read you this page and a half. In the fall of 2003, at the desk of his aviation company in Rawalpindi, as he tried to arrange a flight from Mortensen to northern Afghanistan, where the American hoped to begin building schools, the bull-like Brigadier General Bashir Baz ruminated on the importance of educating all of the region's children and the progress America was making in the war on terror. Bashir paused to watch a live CNN feed from Baghdad. Staring at a small video window inset into the flight manifests, scrolling down his monitor, Bashir was struck silent by the images of wailing Iraqi women carrying children's bodies out of the rubble of a bombed building. As he studied the screen, Bashir's bullish shoulders slumped. "People like me are America's best friends in the region," he said at last, shaking his head ruefully. "I'm a moderate Muslim, an educated man," Bashir said. "But watching this, even I could become a jihadi." "How can Americans say they're making themselves safer?" Bashir asked, struggling not to direct his anger toward the large American target on the other side of his desk. "Your President Bush has done a wonderful job of uniting 1 billion Muslims against America for the next 200 years. "Well, Osama had something to do with that too," Mortensen said. "Osama ba!" Bashir roared. "Osama's not a product of Pakistan or Afghanistan. He's a creation of America. Because of America, Osama is in every home. As a military man, I know you can never fight and win against someone who can shoot at you once and then run off and hide while you have to remain eternally on guard. You have to attack the source of your enemy's strength. In America's case, that's not Osama or Saddam or anyone else. The enemy is ignorance. The only way to defeat it is to build relationships with these people, to draw them into the modern world with education and business. Otherwise, the fight will go on forever." Bashir took a breath and peered back through his tiny window to Baghdad, where a camera crew was filming radicalized young Iraqi men shaking their fists and firing their weapons in the air after setting off a roadside bomb. "Sorry, sir," he said. "I'm really inexcusably rude. Of course, you know this as well as I do. Shall we have lunch?" And then Bashir pushed a button on his intercom and asked his lieutenant to send in the tubs of Kentucky Fried Chicken he'd ordered especially for his American guests. Well, I think that gives you a pretty good sense of somebody who represents the majority of Muslims in the world, the moderates who make up the great majority of people who want the same things that Americans want: peace, opportunity, a better life for their children. And what Bashir also represents in that section is the incredible hospitality of the Pakistani people, finding Kentucky Fried Chicken for his American guests in Rawalpindi, bending over backwards to fly us where we needed to go in helicopters and to take care with our safety and health. And Bashir represents so many people that I met as I was traveling. So I'm going to show you a couple pictures. But for the students in the audience, particularly, before I show you these slides, I'd like you to keep this question on the back burner of your brain while I'm showing these pictures. This is the question I'd like you to think about. What path will I choose in life? What path will I choose in life? We're going to be talking about Greg Mortensen's path in life and a little bit about my path in life, but think about your own, because really that's what this subject raises. All right. So I'm going to show you a couple pictures, and Pete, if we could turn down the lights on me just a little bit so we can see the slides better, that would be tremendous. And then I won't stumble blindly off of the stage as well. Maybe even a little more if you can. Can you guys see the slides pretty well now? Okay. Yeah, that's perfect, just like that. Thank you. So, I'm just going to have a dramatic interlude here while I play with the batteries on my trusty slide advancer, which has never failed me ever in public before and certainly won't now. Perfect. Okay, this is a picture of a really good day at the office for me. And I'm going to show you a couple pictures just from the sort of work that I do when things are going really well. You know, writers spend an awful lot of time wandering around their house, muttering to themselves, in my case, scaring my dog when I'm muttering to myself. But every once in a while, you get to go to a really interesting place, and that was the case here. This is a picture of me in central Vietnam. And I lived in Vietnam for 3 years. I rode my bicycle from Saigon to Hanoi when I first finished graduate school. And I've gone back every year. And I've been writing something about landmine victims in central Vietnam. So I'm going to show you a couple pictures from these trips. And just to give you a sense of the incredible drama and glamour of being a foreign correspondent, this is a picture of me on the worst motorcycle on the face of the earth. This is a Minsk made in Eastern Europe. And you get to go about 5 kilometers on a Minsk before something falls off. And I rode this particular motorcycle into a small village where I was going to interview landmine survivors. And I pulled into the village and I saw a group of elderly women sitting on the ground selling fruits and vegetables. And so I hit the brakes pretty hard thinking I'll pick up some fruit for the road. And I skidded to a stop. And just at that moment, the horn on this motorcycle made this strangled goose noise, sort of like, and fell off. And I thought, I'll probably need that horn. There's a lot of traffic in Vietnam, not in this picture. So I swung my leg over the motorcycle to get down and get the horn, and I put my foot down and down into something very large and moist and warm. And I looked down at what I could see of my foot, which had disappeared up to the ankle, in a giant buffalo turd. And I sort of grabbed my leg by the thigh and started trying to pull it up out of this wet, sucking substance. And I looked over at that moment to the women selling the vegetables, and all of them had their faces in their hands laughing hysterically. And I thought, all right, this foreign correspondent thing isn't quite as suave as I think it is. So one thing I really believe in journalism is you have to travel to the places where the story takes place. That's why I made 3 trips to northern Pakistan for 3 cups of tea. And that's why in writing about landmines and ordnance in Vietnam, it's important to go to the place where the problem is. And for those of you who don't know, all these years after what we call the Vietnam War and what people in Vietnam refer to as the American War, all these years later, there's still somebody in central Vietnam who steps on an old mine or triggers unexploded ordnance and is maimed or killed every single day. It's an enormous problem. More ordnance was dropped in the demilitarized zone of Vietnam than any place on earth during the Vietnam War. So I was traveling with an organization called Clear Path International that was not only helping to remove some of these mines and bombs, but helping to retrain people. This is a farmer who had the poor fortune, while plowing his field, to hit a mine. And that tells you just how insidious this is, because it's a field he had plowed for years and years and years before he struck it. So without your hands as a farmer in Vietnam, it's a pretty tough life. And so this organization did something that's increasingly popular in this part of the country. They took some of the old bomb craters on his land and filled them in with water and turned them into catfish farms. Now, it's a very wise way to deal with a problem and the kind of problem-solving and humanitarian work that really impresses me. Now, the problem of landmine victims in central Vietnam is so widespread that there are even Paralympics held for landmine victims. And these are some of the athletes that I met after they had medaled. And this gentleman here was a bicycle racer. And I asked him how he did it, and he took out his bicycle and showed me and whipped around the parking lot of the building where we were speaking, steering with his elbows. It's just an amazing process. Now, this is a picture I took visiting a 5th grade classroom. And there was one place in central Vietnam called Dom Ha, which got the worst of the bombing and mining. And people said this particular field in Dom Ha could never be cleared. And so this American organization went in with ground-penetrating radar, and they cleared all of the mines and the bombs down to 30 feet deep, and they built a school and a playground on the site of the minefield. And so this is the president of the 5th grade class of the Clear Path International School giving a very nervous speech to me, very rehearsed speech in English, asking me to thank Americans for clearing the bombs and mines from her school and playground. Now I'm going to show you a couple pictures from a trip that I just took a month and a half ago. And this is the book that I'm working on now. And I've just got probably 6 or 7 pictures here, and then I'm going to go to pictures from 3 cups of tea. But this is what I'm spending my days on now, and I'd like to share this with you. This is a picture of me about to watch eye surgery, cataract surgery in Nepal. And after 3 cups of tea, many people doing terrific humanitarian work have clogged up my email box asking me to tell their story now. And I can't tell all these stories, obviously, but this is a story that I'm struggling to learn about and tell now. There are 2 surgeons, a brilliant American surgeon named Jeff Tabin, who has all the fancy degrees, Harvard Medical School, Oxford University, etc. And after he was trained as a doctor, he went to Nepal to sort of teach the natives a thing or two as an expert surgeon. And he went to work with a Nepalese surgeon named Sandik Ruit. And he realized, as he was working with Sandik Ruit, that he knew nothing compared to this guy. Now, Sandik Ruit had grown up in a village very much like the 3 cups of tea villages in eastern Nepal, with no running water, no electricity, no road to the village. And his father said to him, if you're going to make something of yourself, we've got to get you to school. And he walked with him 12 days to India and enrolled him in school in Darjeeling, India. Now, Sandik did so well in school that when he took the medical boards in India, he placed number 1 in the entire country of India. And then he said, I'm not going to go be a fancy doctor somewhere else. He had offers to go work for rich people all over the world. He said, I'm going back to Nepal, and I'm going to change people's lives in Nepal. And he founded an eye hospital and began doing surgery in the remote parts of Nepal to cure preventable blindness. So Jeff Tabin, the fancy Harvard doctor, realized, all right, I've got more to learn from this guy than I could teach him. I'm just going to apprentice. So the 2 of them now have been working together for more than a decade, and they founded an organization called the Himalayan Cataract Project, and they've done hundreds of thousands of free surgeries curing preventable blindness. This surgery costs about $1,500 in the United States. They've figured out a way to do it for $10 in Nepal. And they've been so successful with it that the United Nations has asked them to expand to sub-Saharan Africa. The U.S. military has asked them to retrain how military medical ships work when they go into areas, to train them how to leave trained personnel behind, not just show up, do a good deed, and go away. So anyway, I'm struggling to learn enough about eyes and medicine to tell this story, but the first thing I had to do was watch somebody cut an eyeball open. And for a squeamish person like me, that was a little unnerving. So this is a picture of me about to see my first eyeball cut into. Now, I watched several surgeries at the hospital that these 2 built in Kathmandu, and then we went out to Rasawa in central Nepal, a remote area in the center of the country. You may have heard of the Maoist insurgency that has now taken control of the government in Nepal. They just won the recent elections. And this was an area in the center of Nepal that was one of the poorest parts of the country. And people here lived as people do in the 3 cups of tea villages, just subsistence farming. And so Dr. Ruit and Dr. Tabin set up a field hospital in a military checkpost that was a place where we probably would have been shot last year if we'd showed up as foreigners. But now that the Maoists are in control, they invited us to go in. And they set up a hospital and put out the call, and thousands of people carried their blind relatives on their backs down mountain trails to this facility. And I interviewed this woman as she was preparing for surgery. Her name was Padali Nepali. And Padali had been a tailor most of her life. Her family was very poor. They didn't have land. And as she began to lose her eyesight, she worried what she would do to keep her family afloat if she couldn't sew. And finally, she went completely blind. The family had no resources. And in desperation, she sold her sewing machine, which was the last valuable thing the family had. So Padali heard that these surgeons were coming nearby. Her husband carried her for a day on his back to bring her to the surgery. And I asked him how she got there. And he said, oh, she came by taxi. And I looked around and there were no roads. And he said, yeah, basket taxi. I'm the taxi. So Padali was very nervous about having the surgery. But I spoke to her and I said, these doctors are world class and please have the courage to go through with it. I think you'll like the results. So here she is having her eye anesthetized and being prepared for the surgery. The genius of the work these guys are doing is they've created a conveyor belt. Each surgery takes 7 or 10 minutes. It's incredibly fast and they have results that are almost exactly the same level of success as we have in the developed world. So it's a remarkable thing. These are patients. Here's Podley, and here are some other patients being prepared for surgery. Here's Podley after she's had the surgery. And this is a Maoist soldier. You can see his hammer and sickle windbreaker here. This is one of the guys who might have taken a shot at me last year, and we worked together all day long bringing the patients in and out. And this is one day's worth of surgeries. After surgery the following morning, waiting to be examined and to see how the surgery went. And this is Podley, waiting for her bandages to come off, waiting for Dr. Ruit to examine her and see if the surgery was a success. And here she is seeing for the first time in years. And unfortunately, what she was seeing was me. There was this strange, foreign, sweaty, unshaven reporter crouching in front of her with a camera and a notebook. And I said, don't look at me, don't look at me. Your husband's over there. Look at him. And so here she is seeing her husband for the first time in several years. And I asked her, well, how does he look? And Podley said, the same, still handsome. So I'm going to change gears now and talk about 3 cups of tea. That gives you an idea of what I'm working on at the moment. That's the same kind of travel and the same kind of experience that I had while I was in northern Pakistan working on 3 cups of tea. This is a picture of me about to leave on my first reporting trip for 3 cups of tea. And this helicopter here is called an Alouette. It's a French manufacturer. And in Pakistan, they have a nickname for this helicopter. They call it the French Fluke. Because by all rights, it shouldn't still be flying after all these years, but it is. And in the developing world, as many of you know, you use things until they fall apart. You don't just retire them like we do here. Now, all of this would seem very fascinating to you in an air and space museum. But if you're about to climb into this and fly over the tallest mountains on Earth, it's a little worrying. The other thing that worried me, this is me wearing very awkwardly the shalwar kameez. Now, Greg Mortensen insists that everyone who travels with him on CAI business wear the shalwar kameez out of respect for the people in the conservative villages where he works. But what Greg doesn't do is give you operating instructions. And I could have used a whole manual. The pants of the shalwar kameez are, the waist is actually about 5 feet wide. And there's a waistband, an elastic band called an azarband, that you have to thread through this entire waist and then tie just so. And then what Greg didn't tell me is you're supposed to tuck this thing politely into your pants. You're not supposed to walk around like I did with it dangling down your leg like an elephant's trunk. So I think Greg was having a little fun with me. And I got into this helicopter, and when I began arriving in the villages in the Karakoram Himalaya, people seemed so friendly, and they were always laughing when I first saw them and pointing. And it took me a while to realize that it was me walking around with the equivalent of my fly unzipped. Now, this is a picture of younger brothers of the girls at the Gulturi Girls Refugee School outside of Skardu seeing me walk up with my azarband hanging out for the first time. And this is a picture I took out the window of that helicopter on one of my first flights. Now, look at this place. It takes a while to take this picture in. My first reaction to looking out the window was to just sort of swoon at the beauty of northern Pakistan. And we're in an area here called the Hunza Valley in the far northwest of Pakistan on the Afghan border. And if you look at this from the air, you might think, you know, this is a vacation destination. It's a beautiful spot. But if you spend time on the ground in some of these houses here in the villages, you realize that life for people in these villages is very, very difficult. This is a very high altitude area. And if you're lucky enough to live in these houses here and have some of the good land nearby, then your day probably consists during the growing season of working 12 or 14 hours in the field growing buckwheat or barley to try to put enough food aside to live through the winter. It's a very short growing season and a very long winter, and the trails are snowed in often and people can't get supplies through the winter. Now, if you don't have that land right near your homes, you might have to go a little further. You might have to farm on a slope like this, or a slope like this, or this is the field that always gets me, a field like this. So picture waking up before dawn, switchbacking up the hillside here to your field, digging a little trench by hand so you get a trickle of glacial water to irrigate your crop, and then working all day on a 45-degree slope to try to raise some buckwheat to keep your family alive. It was spending time on the ground in these villages that made me realize just how difficult life was for these people, made me realize that they're trapped in a cycle of poverty, and I began to understand why it was that you didn't see schools and clinics in these villages. People were stuck in this cycle, working like animals round the clock, just trying to set aside enough food to survive. And that's when I realized we have an obligation. With all of the excess in our culture, with all of the fat, with all of the extra funds and resources, it's such a small thing for us, such a simple thing to help people in places like this break this cycle of poverty. It costs a dollar a day for a teacher in a village like this, yet many of the teachers can't afford it. And as I watched Greg Mortensen go from village to village, breaking the cycle of poverty again and again, I became even more impressed with the work that the Central Asia Institute was doing. Now, this is a picture of the village of Corfe. And this is the village that took Greg in after his failed attempt to climb K2 in 1993. And you can see the way that he's beloved by the people of the village of Corfe. It's like he's long lost family. When we walked up, people surrounded him and embraced him and were so glad to see him. And I thought, this is incredible. We're in this, quote, scary Islamic country. We're in this region that gave birth to the Taliban, a place where Americans are supposed to be mistrusted and feared. And yet here is an American being welcomed like this. And I thought, you know, if I come here for years, I probably won't get this kind of reception. And then 5 minutes later, I got the same treatment. And after we took this picture, the students of Corfe took me by the hand and showed me the school that they'd built together. And one young girl, a 12-year-old, said to me, you know, I've heard people say many bad things about Americans, but for me, Americans are the kindest people. They're the only ones who cared to help us. And I think about that point, I was done for. My objectivity was really in danger. And, you know, I've spoke with journalism students today, and you're all familiar with the cliches about journalism, that you're supposed to approach your subject from a distance and put on your press hat and say, just the facts, ma'am. But I found I was having a lot of trouble doing that in a place like this. In fact, if you look at this uncomfortable smile on my face, you can kind of see the objectivity just drifting out of the top of my head like smoke. Because this is me realizing that this is not a story I want to tell from a distance. This is not a story I want to tell in a dry, academic, clinical way. This is an unbelievable story that I want everybody to read about. I want it to be as widely publicized as it can be. I want to get the facts right. I want to be as accurate as I can. But this is an endeavor that I hope to see succeed. So we traveled by French Fluke, and we traveled by Jeep and by foot. And this is a trip that Greg and Ghulam Parvi, the director of the Central Asia Institute in Pakistan, and I took together to visit schools in the far northeast of Pakistan, in Kashmir, on the militarized border with India, a very dangerous place. Just to give you a sense of what the landscape looks like and the scale of things, let's see, we're in Washington, so Mount Rainier would come up to about here on these foothills. These foothills are about 17,000 feet high, and they don't even have names, there's so many of them. As you go up from here, the peaks go up to 28,000 feet. this is what these villages look like on the ground rather than through the window of a helicopter. And you can see how little flat land there is and how dry and rocky the areas often are and what a miracle of human labor it is to grow crops and to survive in a place like this. And one of the most difficult things in a place like this is just getting from point A to point B. This is one of the so-called roads in the Hushay Valley. And what's going on here, you can't see everything, but what you're not seeing in this picture is that there's a drop of 1,000 feet down here to the bottom of the Hushay River Gorge. And we're at a bottleneck here. Greg and I are in a Jeep, and this truck here is backing up to try to get out of our way. While we're sitting here, there are people sitting on top of the truck. I watch this driver bend down, pick up a cassette tape, read the label, stick it in his cassette player, light a cigarette, all while backing the truck up on the edge of the cliff. And I watched rocks spitting off the edge into the abyss here. And right about this time, I looked over and Greg was laughing. And he said, maybe you're beginning to understand. And I looked out down this cliff to the bottom, and at the bottom I could see the charred hulks of buses and jeeps that had fallen off of the road and hadn't been removed because there was no way to get them out of there. And Greg said, so maybe now you're beginning to understand. People always say, aren't you afraid to go work in this crazy terrorist place? But he said, if I die over here, it's not going to be from a bullet. Now, as you get up to the high peaks, they look like this. It's one of the most remarkable places on earth. Is my microphone cutting out at all, or does it sound normal? Normal? Okay. I'm just alerting you that it feels to me like the batteries may be wiggling, so we may need to think of alternatives if it cuts out. These are the high peaks of the Karakoram, and there's no place like this on earth. In this tiny area at the top of the world, there are 64 peaks over 20,000 feet high, all crushed together within 100 square miles. There's literally nothing like it on Earth. The Everest area is incredible, but no place has this many peaks all pushed together. It's just the most exquisite mountain scenery on Earth. And this is the tallest mountain in the region, K2. And this is where Greg joined an expedition in 1993 to try to climb what most mountaineers believe to be the toughest mountain to climb on Earth. And in keeping with the psychotic personalities on this expedition, they decided not to go up the typical route on K2. That would be too easy on the toughest mountain on Earth. They decided to go up the West Ridge, which had only been climbed once before successfully in history. And as those of you who've read the book know, things did not go well. Greg was a support climber, carrying gear back and forth to the high camps so it could be in place when the lead climbers would make a dash to the summit. And when one of those lead climbers, Etienne Finet, came up very quickly, he suddenly had a problem at a high camp. All of a sudden, pink froth started oozing out of his mouth, and he collapsed. And his teammates knew that he... You already are a super lady. To have done so well in school, to have had the courage to go to school and come down out of the mountains and continue your education, you've blazed a path that thousands and thousands of other women are going to follow. And I think it's critically important that we create an army of Jahans, because if we have an army of empowered, educated women in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the extremists will be no match for them. I promise you. So I just want to show you a couple more pictures. This is the shot, remember, out the window of the helicopter. So think again about how I describe the way that people live, working 12 hours in the field, unable often even to go to school. So contrast that picture with this picture. If you're a child from the Hunza Valley or the Hushay Valley and you had the opportunity to spend 4 years here, it would be a dream come true. It would be your wildest fantasy. So to the students here, I urge you to think seriously about the gift that you've been given. You have 4 years here. Savor them. Some of you may have 5 or 6, but I'm talking to most of you. You have You have 4 years here. Savor them. You have all of the resources of the Western world. You can study whatever you want. You can make of yourself whatever you want. You have opportunities that people around the world would die for. So while you have those opportunities, I ask you to think about what you can do with them, what you can give back with them. You know, people sometimes are intimidated by Greg's story and they feel like, well, you know, I can't go build schools in Pakistan. But if you want to help out, if you want to engage with the world, you don't have to get on a plane to Pakistan. You can work right here, locally in Spokane. Can. But just don't mispronounce it. You'll learn lots of things in college. You can work right here locally. There are pockets of poverty in every American community that you wouldn't imagine unless you started to work there. There are children who need after-school tutors. There are children who need big brothers and big sisters. There are food pantries. Some of the worst child hunger in America is in the rural West. I've reported on it and traveled to these places. There are food pantries and organizations that would love your help just a few hours a month. And I think you'll find that it really changes not only your life, but the lives of innumerable people. So while you have this opportunity, let's return to that question I asked you to keep on the back burner of your brain. The question is, what path will you choose in life? What path will you choose in life? And one more question I'd like to leave you with. What effect will the path that you choose have on other people in the rest of the world? Thanks very much for listening. The question is, how is it that for people who are moving around, if you could, if you can make the moving around noises but not the talking noises, we'd do better for a few minutes. How is it that the CAI schools are not targeted by the Taliban?
Check.
You know, the amazing thing about the way these schools are built is that if these were schools dropped out of a plane by the U.S. military, they'd be gone in a week. But the brilliance of this process is that people consider them their own schools. They consider them community schools. Every CAI school was built on land that the village donated themselves,
labor
that the village donated themselves, and then the CAI provides money and skilled labor and materials. And so I think the first important thing is that the ownership of the schools is local. The people consider them their schools, not a gift they've been given. Also, you know, you hear in the media all of the dramatic and violent things that are happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Most of the schools are in such remote areas that they're isolated from resources during good times and often protected from the turbulence of politics during bad times. So today, all 78 schools are up and running. They're doing fine. One school in Afghanistan was briefly taken over by the Taliban. One school that was located in the middle of nowhere, a school that was built in a location that, in my opinion, was a mistake. But the principal rode his bicycle after the Taliban snatched the school, rode 25 miles at night to the home of a local, what we would call warlord, and the local people call commandant, because he knew that this commandant's daughters were students. And this warlord rounded up his men, and they shot up the Taliban, killed four of them, tortured several of the others, and asked them, took over the school. The school was up and running 2 days later. And asked them, the ones that they tortured, why'd you do this? Why'd you take the school? And this speaks to the oversimplifications of the way we talk about the subject. These guys didn't take the school because they didn't believe girls should be educated. They said they heard that a rich American was in charge of the school, and they figured if they grabbed it, there would be some money in it for them. So all too often what we chalk up to hard and fast ideology is just thuggery or greed. And when I talk about root causes, again, that's what I'm talking about, poverty and ignorance. Someone else have a question?
Could you briefly summarize what Mortensen is doing since the book is finished?
Yeah. What Greg is doing, the dramatic answer, what I should say is that he's spent every day in Afghanistan opening thousands of schools. Mostly what Greg is doing is what I'm doing tonight. speaking in front of groups of people because the success of the book has created a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get the Central Asia Institute on solid financial footing. So if any of you are thinking of donating to the Central Asia Institute, I've seen the schools. There are no glass and steel skyscrapers being built on the proceeds of the Central Asia Institute. It's run on very low overhead. But what he's doing when he's not speaking is overseeing taking some of those resources and building new schools. And the book ended with Greg going to Afghanistan and trying to build a school. And there are a dozen schools in Afghanistan now. And in fact, the Wakhan Corridor, some of you may remember that the horsemen rode down over the pass, the Urshad Pass, and said, why don't you come back with us, you know, for the winter, and we'll have a good discuss, and you can build some schools later. And Greg said, well, my wife wouldn't like that if I just left, but I promise you I'll help you when I can. Now there are six schools in the Wakhan Corridor. This is the most remote part of Afghanistan. It's a little arm that reaches over into Pakistan. There have never been formal schools in this area before. And in typical Three Cups of Tea fashion, the local people said, we don't really like the way you're building schools with these right angles. That doesn't really suit us. We're nomadic. We'd like the schools to be star-shaped. So they are. And now they're called the Sitara or Star Schools. And so those are up and running, and there are also many more schools popping up in Badakhshan, the area where the book ends, where Sadr Khan asked Greg to turn stones into schools, and those stones are already schools. Thanks for the question. Someone else have a question? Yes.
How are the teachers trained for the schools?
Sure. The question is, how are the teachers trained? And I just want to say for the next question or two, if anyone in the back has a question, please just wave your arms. I don't want to leave you out just because we've got the microphone up here, and I'll try to call on someone back there. But the question is, how are the teachers trained? The teachers are drawn from a pool of local people. It would be pretty tricky if you took a teacher from Spokane and dropped him into Corfe and said, you know, brush up on Balti and start teaching now. So each teacher is the person in each community who's the most educated, most qualified, who wants to teach. And in some cases, they may just be a fifth grade graduate themselves. But as my wife, who's an elementary school teacher, often tells me, it's not the building that matters, and it's not the test scores that matter. It's the quality of the teachers and the resources and the training. So all of the teachers have continuing education, and there are teacher training seminars every summer, and the teachers come down out of the mountains to Skardu and other areas, and master teachers from both Pakistan and abroad come and have workshops with them and have a resource library. And so each year the teachers become a bit more accomplished. But this is one of the problems. The U.S. State Department has refused to fund the schools because the teachers don't meet their criteria. We have a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of red tape. And I think as we go forward dealing with this crisis in this part of the world, we need to think seriously about reforming some of that bureaucracy, because the Central Asia Institute's been a lot more successful than the government has been working in the area so far. Someone else have a question? Anyone in the back like to just shout one out? Okay. Oh, you're naming my tune, and I could keep you here for another hour, but I'm going to do two things. I'm going to not give you a 1 hour answer, and I'm not going to make a giant political statement, much as I'm tempted right before the election. But what I'll say is, to me, the critical, approach in our foreign policy to the region is to stop supporting dictators and anyone who's in charge just simply because we want to use them in the so-called war on terror. The critical thing we need to do differently is let the people of the region understand we're there to help them, to support them. I talked about that airlift of helicopters that everyone in Pakistan saw on TV. If our next American president gave an address directed to the Pakistani people saying, We understand your suffering. We're all suffering from extremism and terrorism. We want the same things. And so we're going to look to models like the Marshall Plan, where we rebuilt Europe, and we're going to extend those kinds of opportunities to you. I think you would find a very, very receptive audience among the Pakistani and Afghan people. So I hope our next leaders will have the wisdom to reach out directly to the Pakistan and Afghan people and let them know that we don't want to just use them as pawns in a game of the war on terror, that in exchange for improving their lives, they'll help us and we'll work together to eliminate the extremism that's plaguing us both.
David, over here, final question right here.
Sure.
Throughout this whole course and journey you've gone on, do you regret anything you've done?
This is, you know, this reminds me of the preview that I just saw for the movie W, where our president was asked what you've done wrong so far and what lessons you've learned. And I'm not going to exhibit the hubris to say that I haven't done anything wrong. I'll tell you, I'm actually pretty happy with the way things have gone overall. There are small things I would change. I wouldn't misquote Mother Teresa like I did in the book. I think that was a mistake, and I've heard from nuns all over America, and I've put in corrections for later editions. There are other minor details that I got wrong that I would fix, but overall, I feel really proud and pleased not only about how Three Cups of Tea works as a book, but especially about the effect that the book is having on the conversation in America. The fact that the military is requiring officers about to serve in Afghanistan to read the book, that the U.S. Army War College that the U.S. Army War College is requiring it to be taught, that so many people in so many levels of our military leadership and our government are now understanding that our course needs to be corrected. So I'm very pleased. The way I think of it is sort of like the ship of state is this giant oil tanker, and I'm at the back with a canoe paddle just frantically going this way a little bit, this way a little bit. And I'm happy to feel that I've had a tiny part in steering that. But anyway, I don't want to end with that. I just want to speak again to any students who are still listening and just urge you again, you don't have to change the world all at once. You don't have to drop your life. You don't have to be in Pakistan or Afghanistan to make a difference. You can do it right here. And I think that anybody who's listening, whether you're a student or not, that's a lesson we can all learn. And if this book inspires anybody to connect with their communities and the wider world, then it's been a terrific experience for me. All right, thanks so much for listening.